Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winna Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hello, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. Oliver, did you know that every week we start out by taking a question from a listener on our own pop culture tastes? This week, the thing that I want you to tell me, Oliver, is what song will you absolutely always sing along to at the top of your lungs?
So I'm going to take the spirit of this question and answer it a little bit from sideways. This question made me think of a great scene from a slightly underrated, though really not that great of a movie, called The Boat That Rocked, which is about the 1960s pirate radio ships that were off the coast of the UK back.
Was that movie good? Because, like, I saw trailers for it and I was like, I like this period of history, but I don't think that will be good.
It had every great British character actor you could possibly want, including Bill Nye and Chris O'Dowd. I mean, yeah, and I can never pronounce his name correctly. It's Rise? It's like R.
Reese.
Is that Reese?
Okay. Yeah.
Reese Iflin? Thank you. Yeah, this is really completely.
You guys, we've been sending Oliver to Welsh pronunciation classes, but he just won't devote himself to his work.
So there's a scene in the film where Chris O'Dowd plays one of the morning DJs, and he's just been left by his wife, his new bride, for another DJ at the station. Sorry, spoiler alert. And he puts on Lorraine Ellison's Stay With Me, Baby, which was a song that I had not been familiar with. But he basically lip syncs through the climactic part of the song. And do we have this queued up, perchance, Colin?
No, no, I can't believe you're leaving me.
We're all feeling it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so O'Dowd does a great, just masterful lip sync to it. And I just love the emotion, the emotiveness of it. So this question made me think of that scene, which you can find online. I don't know. I guess I would kind of recommend the movie, even though it's flawed. But there's nothing I like better than watching scenes of people listening to the radio, because it taps into every kind of romantic impulse I've ever had about the romance of radio itself.
Oliver, if you have questions about whether I will watch a flawed British comedy of the 1990s or 2000s, apparently we haven't been in the same room for the past 8 months learning about each other.
Well, you should check it out then. It's good. It's good. It's not great. It could be much, much better, but yeah. It's watchable.
Margaret Wappler, what will you always sing along to?
Rufus Wainwright. His debut album is one of those albums that I never really dropped out of circulation. Like, it came out in 98, and I think even if I don't listen to it for maybe 6 months or something, all of a sudden I just will, and I just sit there and sing to it, or I move around the house doing whatever I'm doing and sing to it. And particularly the opening track, Foolish Love, which is arranged by Van Dyke Parks, and it's just this sweeping, unabashedly romantic, completely not holding back kind of song. I don't know. Should we hear any of it, Colin?
I don't want to hold you and feel so helpless.
Have you seen him live?
Yes.
He's great live.
He's amazing live. I've seen him a number of times, actually. And I have to say, too, the thing that I love about this song is that it takes a couple of different turns. Like, it starts in this kind of quieter, almost wistful, sad kind of place, and then it goes someplace more playful. And I love songs that do that, too, that it's like it has that musical quality where you're, like, moving through a story in the song.
Winner, what will you always sing along to?
I think Dog Days Are Over by Florence and the Machine. It makes me, like, super weepy. But then it's also very much like, I don't know, it kind of, like, sounds like closure and an opening.
It's such a weird emotional journey for
it's a weird emotional journey. And I always just remember every place I was where I've heard it, and I remember the moment that I started singing it loud like that. So I just absolutely love that song. It's one of the only songs, I have to be honest, that I love from her.
Yeah.
I think she kind of does the same thing all the time. But to debut with that being like her first hit single is like legendary status. I mean, I think everybody's heard the song.
Colin, can we get a little bit of it?
But let's hear it anyways. Happiness hit her like a train on a
track. Coming towards her. It's emotional, isn't it? Stuck still, no turning
back. So any music that I listen to is music that I also sing along to, like that is ripe to be sung along to at the top of one's lungs. So I had to evaluate this in terms of what A has had this quality to me the most, and also what song demands the most of one's lungs and voice. And I just went back to Love Shack because it is a song that insists that you sing along with it. It is a song that, like, whatever it is that Fred Schneider does,
yes,
needs to be respected as an art form in and of itself.
They need to
and
put
the
in
other
Smithsonian.
Two ladies. I mean, sometimes I'll just think about that line, tin roof rusted.
Yes.
Like, that'll just come.
Tin roof rusted.
It'll just come to me.
It's so good. Oliver.
Okay, I got chills again.
Did you just call it Colin? Colin.
Yes.
I guess we both
Colin.
Have very British names.
Yes, you do. If you see a faded sign by the side of the road that says 16 miles, I don't know if it's 15 or 16. Kate Pearson, you gave us so much.
I love her voice in this song. Mm. The way it cracks.
It's, yes, it's a little raw and ragged.
So raw
she's
and
been
ragged.
Partying
yeah.
hard.
Yeah, it's... I mean,
love them. B-52's rule.
Also, there's that weird way as a gay kid, like 80% of gay stuff terrifies you completely.
Yes.
And then the other 20% you don't know to understand it as gay.
Yes.
And you're just like, that's the best thing ever.
Exactly.
Those ladies are great. Thanks to Rach Tacular for that question.
Oh, Rach Tacular.
Rach Tacular.
One of our close personal friends on the mm-hmm. Facebook forums. If you've got a question you'd like us to answer about our pop culture taste, send them to our Reddit, Twitter, or post it on the Facebook group. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to talk about the recent misfortunes that befell the Stonewall movie that came out, and also talk about the gay culture we do love. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams, but first, let us find out what arts and entertainment news or events have got our attention this week. Winner, what are you all about this week?
Oh, Scream Queens. And look, I'm already prepared for the onslaught, and I don't even want to fucking hear it, so save your fucking breath, all right? I think the show is phenomenal. It has tons of flaws. There are many ways that it's problematic. But I think, I don't know if it's maturity or I don't know if I've just seen a lot of TV in my lifetime. But can we just get to a point where we can accept something for just 100% what it is?
I mean,
the show is totally trashy, totally like... tropey, and there's a lot of things in there that are totally offensive, but at the same time, it's totally entertaining.
Well, I wanted to ask you, what is the main thing people are offended by?
They're offended by the fact, well, okay, the first hugest offense to me is that Emma Roberts is literally playing the same character that she's been playing for legitimately like the last 5 years. But she makes several comments that are super racist and homophobic.
I think it's the classic Ryan Murphy thing of taking an extremely beautiful woman or young girl and having her say extremely conservative, derogatory things about
yes,
people.
Yes, yes. And she does it in a way that it's just flippant and off the tongue. There's also, they don't give a lot, they basically take every type of person and put them in a position to, they have a deaf girl, no, spoiler alert, her head gets cut off the first, while she's singing and she doesn't know that she can't hear the tractor coming. So like they cut her head off, they have the stereotypical black security guard who's like, you know, fumbling around and not, you know, these white girls need to learn how to run away from trouble. But there's also like so many elements of it that are just amazing. Jamie Lee Curtis is it's so good to see her again.
Lee Curtis working just makes me so happy.
It makes me happy, and her cleavage makes me happy. And the fact that she uses it and that she's totally committed to like graying short cropped hair like Kris Jenner. And then there's also the fact that it's now taking elements of shows and movies from past that I grew up watching. So the Halloween, the Scream, the I Know What You Did Last Summer, the Nightmare on Elm Street. There's all of these elements in a show that's totally set in a college campus. So it's sorority and fraternity. My favorite character of the show, though, I have to say, is the guy who plays Emma Roberts' boyfriend, who lets his roommate, played by Nick Jonas, sleep in bed with him, and she catches them. And instead of the typical, like, no, I'm not gay, he's like, I have to break up with you because you're homophobic. If my bro wants to sleep in the bed with me because he's scared, I'm going to let him. And don't tell anyone he's gay. He's going to choose to talk about it on his own. It's just like there's a lot of ridiculous scenarios. But then if you don't understand, like, satire, then you won't laugh when Ariana Grande is texting while she, while she dies. She's texting the killer in face-to-face.
I do love how much they put people who are only in one episode of the show in the initial, like, press run.
Sure.
I haven't watched the show yet. I do think a Ryan Murphy show is to be appreciated for the first season before it goes off the rails. Though some of my friends who have watched the show are getting a little bit tired of the glibness and the pastiche-ness. We are spending so much time building shows out of, ha-ha, don't we all know that trope, that we're not making
new tropes.
Like,
we know this is racist, and just because we know that it's racist doesn't mean it's still funny.
Well, more than that, just sort of like, oh, the bitchy, pretty, popular girls, and, you know, like,
just riffing off of basically
stereotypes.
Well-worn. No, well, but you're riffing off of well-worn narrative tropes,
like,
basically.
My friend Ryan was like, I mean, so, yeah, we've got Clueless, and we've got Mean Girls, you know, we know this stuff, and we're just kind of like...
But it never... But it goes back to when we did our high school episode.
Yeah.
That this is something perennially that just will never go away, going to school. Like, as long as you go to school, you're... I have to be honest, this version of college makes me really happy that I skipped out on it. Because if I went to a college like the way I imagine this is how it's set up now, it's terrible. Mm. Just take away the murders and the serial killer and the passive aggression. Like, it is a terrible environment. Where do people learn? There's never in a classroom once, right, by the way.
Oliver and
I haven't seen them in it was 2 hours, no classroom.
Oliver and I went to Berkeley, where everyone on their first day of school puts on a cow sweatshirt and immediately becomes a slightly overweight Chinese woman. We all do that for 5 years, and we take it off and we go back to our regular lives. But in the process, you learn about Greek history.
Did you like Cabin in the Woods?
I didn't see Cabin in the
Woods.
I did.
It.
I love it.
It's so good.
That's deliberately riffing on all of the tropes of horror films, but doing it in a way that I thought was done really smart and clever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very Whedon-esque.
Very Whedon.
Oliver, what are you all about this week?
Also a television show, also satirical, which is Documentary Now, which is on IFC. It is a Seth Meyers exec-produced show that stars Bill Hader and Fred Armisen. And apparently Fred Armisen is now the go-to guy for any time you need him to play multiple different kinds of characters in a mock satirical way. Like, he's the guy to go with. But each episode, I mean, the intro graphics completely nail the PBS style of documentary. And Documentary Now, I think, is supposed to be basically making fun of POV. And each episode is a
different... God, I love POV.
Yeah. Each episode is a riff on a different kind of documentary. So the very first one is called, I think, Sandy Shores, and it's basically riffing off of
Grey Gardens.
Right.
I just look at that picture and I laugh.
Right. And the second one is uncovering, you know, Canuck, which is making fun of the Nanook of the North, which is sort of one of the early kind of ethnographic cinema verite documentaries. There's one that's gotten the most run, which is making fun of Vice and Vice's style of documentary. Mm-hmm. And then the most recent one, we're looking at rock biopic documentaries about this, like, you know, yacht rock group from the fake group from the 70s called Blue Jean Committee. And what I like about it is, number one, it completely does nail, like, what do document, like, just the production style of documentaries and what we're used to seeing. If you watch a lot of documentaries, you get all the in jokes. But at least in the first two episodes I've seen, they also take great care in throwing you for a loop in terms of, if it was just purely a satirical look at a particular kind of documentary, I think that could get kind of boring after a while. But I think they also throw in things that you absolutely don't expect at all in terms of – yeah, they throw in a lot of elements of surprise that I think keeps it a little bit more fresh than just a purely satiric product.
There is a way that I can get annoyed with how unimaginative our casting directors can be, and how unimaginative networks can be in sort of like taking the same people and putting them on every show. I can get annoyed with that. We have a lot of SNL people and former The State people who are everywhere, including on many shows that I work on, and I think that they are talented and great. But the point that I didn't realize until this moment is how much Fred Armisen has been a source for smart comedy that is not scared to be smart. Like, there's so much stupid smart comedy out there, which I don't think is very smart. There's so much, oh, well, we know that they're smart people, but then they're just making this poop joke. But when you think about what Portlandia has been throwing at us for the past five seasons, and then this, like, I need to give that man more respect.
They have understand motivation more. Hader and Fred Armisen understand motivation more than anything. any more than most people. Like, they to set a show like Portlandia in Portland and really make fun of the people there and do it for as long as they did without it getting bored or
it's a responsible sense of character.
Exactly.
Like, it is very easy on a joke intensive show to have no respect for the idea of it being an integrated character who has humanity to them. Mm-hmm. They're just a person who is potentially saying jokes, and they never fall into that.
No.
And I respect it. This week, I am all about, it is the Jewish holiday of Sukkot, which is a thing I have a beef with. For those of you who live in all parts of America that aren't Los Angeles or New York, Sukkot is a weird, stupid fall holiday where...
Why have I never heard of this?
Because it's a stupid holiday where we have to eat in a booth. Like, we have to make a little hut.
And, oh, yes!
And we have to eat in it. Not that I do that. The thing is that it is the one time of year that we have, like, a holiday where we're doing something that Gentiles aren't. And we never make it pretty. We never sort of, like, lean into it and say, you guys always have something better every time we have a holiday. We've got Hanukkah, you've got Christmas. We've got Passover, you've got Easter. And we could own this shit and, like, relish it. But our huts are, like, the huts in practice end up just being terrible little...
Yeah, you can't decorate them.
No, you can. We just don't. Because Judaism is only concerned about the laws of things.
Right.
And it has to be seven hand breadths in height. And the stuff on top needs to be made.
What are hand breadths?
Shh, let me finish. And you have to have the stuff on top be sort of like organic things that grew up from the ground and were cut off. And that just means a lot of bamboo and fiberglass and stuff like that. So we answered it in a very, very lovely way in 2010 with a thing called Sukkah City in New York, which was basically treating it like a Project Runway challenge and saying to a bunch of architectural firms, what would you do with these constraints? And they set up an area where the 10 finalists got to actually build it. And it's just so lovely to see, like, gorgeous Sukkot. And there's a documentary that is available on iTunes that sort of, like, takes you through it. And it's not an amazing documentary. It's pretty much just like an episode of Top Chef or Project Runway. But even if you just go to the website Sukkah City, it, like, gives me life and excitement that people will maybe sort of, like, take on this silly little challenge with a little bit more sense of, because Jews tend to approach everything with, well, we may have to flee the country at any given point in time. Let's just get it done as minimally as possible and move along. And it's like, hey, guys, maybe we can rest and realize that this is a fall holiday where maybe you could do some things that are pretty. And the trend hasn't really taken on. There have been some subsequent Sukkah City competitions that people have done at colleges and stuff. But I love the trend. I love the sentiment and would love if more places ended up taking a stab at making them something other than just a tarp.
I would just think that in a Pinterest age that we would have already been past this, that there'd be some, like, Dwell special issue just dedicated to, like, you know, fancy. Is it Sukkah or Sukkot?
Sukkah is the singular. Sukkot is the plural. Also the name of the holiday.
Got it.
You would think so, Oliver. And I have many people who have, like, pushed back at me with this, with, like, oh, my synagogue does a beautiful one. Mm. But I feel like you cannot underestimate the extent to which Judaism does not care. Judaism has never answered where we go when we die, but I know how much horseradish I have to eat on Passover. Like, that's the core of my religion, is rules and regulations. But this one is, like, such – like, it was so cool because hand breadth is how wide your hand is.
Okay.
One of the things is
– 7 is not a lot.
The stuff on top can't be more than 4 hand breadths in width. So one of them was just a plexiglass – like 3 plexiglass walls with 1 gigantic log on top of it, which was Very witty, not my favorite, but fun.
What do you eat?
Oh, you can eat anything. I've always said that all Jewish holidays, the story of every Jewish holiday is people tried to kill us. They only mostly succeeded. So now you either eat, don't eat, or eat in a weird way. And Sukkot is a you have to eat outside. And I think maybe you're like there's a notion that you should eat dairy dishes.
Mark. You would think that Sukkot, the trend of making them beautiful or at least interesting would really take root in L.A. where we have like the weather that's perfect right now for it.
No, it's a friend of mine is converting to Judaism because she's getting married to a Jew. And the thing she loved about it was you're eating al fresco in like the last period of time when it really like makes perfect sense. And I'm like, yeah, we really should, you know, embrace it. So 2% of our audience, let's be honest, 3% of our audience that's Jewish, go crazy. Margaret, what are you all about this week?
I'm all about Grace Jones performing at the Hollywood Bowl last night. For one thing, let me just say a big shout out to the Hollywood Bowl itself. I love the venue so much. It makes me feel like summer in LA is complete when I go there.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been there yet this summer, which is insane for me because I usually try to go at least 4, 5, 6 times, even if I'm just in the cheap seats or whatever, or just picnicking. And then I leave after like the band I want to see. I just like to be there. The whole atmosphere is wonderful. And Grace Jones is very ideal to see there because she is just 100% this like wild panther of a show person. For this show in particular, last time I saw her about 4 years or so at the Bowl, she had a bit of a different aesthetic going on where she was changing in and out of a lot of like really high fashion kind of outfits that were very vivid and saturated colors. And this time she stuck to this really black and white Keith Haring inspired body paint get up. And when I say body paint, I mean she was like 2% clothes. Oh, and then the rest of her was painted in this insane, like Keith Haring, black and white, like kind of tribal, kind of downtown New York combination. And she just 100% owns the stage. And she moves between, she kind of does this really interesting code switching all the time where she's moving in between like downtown punk kind of rock star feeling to like Jamaican patois to, you know, high fashion, like, you know, Gautier is going to come out and party with her all of a sudden. Like, you just don't know what's going to happen. And it's just electrifying. And she's 67. That's the other thing. Mm. So she's 67 years old. She's wearing body paint and like maybe a thong at the Hollywood Bowl. And she also, she's touring right now, not really on a new album, but because she wrote a memoir. And in the memoir, she apparently takes down quite a few different people of this era. And one of my favorite disses that I read about is her saying that Rihanna has done something similar, but that Rihanna did body paint but wore a bodysuit underneath it. So screw that. Not legit.
So I didn't realize that has Grace Jones been touring for the past 30 years? And I just didn't know about it until this sort of like hard comeback tour?
No, she really just reemerged about 4 or 5 years ago with a new record. The first one that she had done, I think, since like the late 80s. Mm. Uh-huh. She really took some time off and was just like out of that scene. But whatever break she was on did wonders for her because she just like came back like the phoenix
but
and
also,
just has been
that's a real
ruling.
Comeback. It's so nice to have somebody you didn't realize you missed show back up and they haven't been like hosting extra for the past 10 years.
And you know, there's something... There's something about her, too, that makes me want to just pull Madonna aside and be like, psst, take notes. Take notes. This is how you do aging. This is how you still own it and be fiery and bold and sexy, but, like...
I forgot Madonna was on tour. So she, like, the one thing that I really find interesting about Grace Jones, because I've been reading... Now I can't wait to read the memoir, is I've been reading a lot about her because I've always had... She's always scared me.
And she knows that. She plays with that, too.
Yes.
In her show.
But now that I'm older, I feel like I appreciate that fear because reading about her now, I see all the risks that she took and all the things. And the best story that I've read so far is when she screamed at the Grammy after party. And she was talking about, like, basically she thought she was going to win. She went on stage and, like, actually handed the award and then was really, like, not happy that she lost and then went to the Grammy after party. She lost her invite. They wouldn't let her in, and they escorted her out, and she just let out this scream as they were leading her out of the party. And I the way she tells the story, I can totally imagine it happening in real time, and I want to be her best friend now.
Yeah, I really like thinking about the Paris apartment in the 70s that her and Jerry Hall and Jessica Lange shared. It's like,
the
what
stories
kind of
those walls could talk
exactly
about, right? Or no, her relationship with Dolph Lundgren.
I will never be friends with Grace Jones, and that is why I love her. It's just,
yeah,
she does exist on like another plane.
Yeah,
another
a goddess should be unapproachable. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to talk about Stonewall and gay films after this.
I listen to Bullseye because I want to feel as passionately about things that I love as Jesse Thorne does. His shows just become essential to me. Just can't imagine not listening.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to Russell Simmons, the co-founder of Def Jam Records, and to music journalist Carl Wilson on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And this week, a movie called Stonewall by Roland Emmerich came out, which was an attempt to dramatize the 1969 riots that were sort of the birth of the modern gay rights movement. Since the trailer for this movie came out, there have been voices from the LGBT community getting worried or pissed off about the ways that it was taking liberties with the story. The past week has basically been a bloodbath of deeply, deeply bitchy, snarky reviews, mostly by gay men, trying to take this movie down a peg. I contributed one of those reviews. And so I wanted to talk about the movie, to talk about the culture of criticism and snark around the movie, and also talk about the gay movies or TV shows or whatever culture that we have loved that we do think managed to succeed where this movie failed. Who here got a chance to see Stonewall?
I did.
Margaret Wappler, what were your thoughts on that movie?
Well, first of all, I just want credit for paying real American dollars to see this movie where you saw a screener, Guy. I basically pity screwed this movie. And I paid for my friend's ticket, so
I might get pity screwed later.
That's like a quarter of their weekend box office.
I know.
This movie has tanked pretty bad. All right, Margaret. Mm-hmm. What was your experience of Stonewall the movie?
I will say that I was hoping, and you saw this hope of mine on Facebook when we were all talking about how terrible the trailer looked. I was hoping that the trailer was just a hot mess in and of itself, and that when you'd go into the movie, it would end up doing something better with the 120 minutes or whatever that it had. And no, it's really pretty much a train wreck. I mean, not every single scene is a disaster, but almost all of the important ones are.
So, like, the movie basically creates this fictionalized, perfect Midwestern Caucasian boy who's barely gay. Like, when somebody tells him that Judy Garland has died, he says, Judy who?
Right.
And
oh, my God.
He comes on a bus from Indiana after he is caught blowing the quarterback of the football team. Why can't a free safety get some action in a teen movie? He comes in. He meets a multi-ethnic group of flamboyant street hustlers who are too ethnic and effeminate for him to ever actually love. And he goes on an adventure. It was, like, to me, there was a lot of criticism of the fact that there was not enough representation of trans characters or characters of color. I think Emmerich attempted to present those things very poorly. Like, he cast a lot of non-trans people in trans roles who did not seem to understand what that means. He cast a lot of straight people in gay roles. That scene where Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Jeremy Irving or whatever his name is are, like, supposed to be having like a romantic dinner together, I was like, oh, this is what straight guys think two gay guys flirting with each other looks like. But the thing that bothered me is that Stonewall is so much the story of a downtrodden community getting shit on one too many times and sort of like standing up for itself. I mean, it is kind of a very Rosa Parks moment of like, not anymore. And this had none of that. He was just so fresh. You had no sense of character from anybody there who was over the age of 25. Like, you had no one who had spent a life being shit upon. And, Margaret, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the police show up and, like, the bad guy owner of the Stonewall is about to kill them for not being human trafficked right, and the police show up, it's a good thing that saves our hero. Like, he gets not like a nod. Do you remember this?
What do you mean it's a good thing that saves him?
Like, the chaos happens because the police are showing up, so that guy is not able to, like, hurt them in any way. And they run out, and then the police officer nods at Ray, the Puerto Rican drag queen, like, attempted boyfriend of Charlie, and they are given a free pass to leave the bar. Like, it is a situation where that cop is weirdly semi a good guy.
Yeah, you know, it really bugged me that when the riots started happening, the point of view basically switches to the cop's perspective. Like, oh, we're trapped in the Stonewall while they're about to burn this building down. Poor us. And I felt like that perspective switch was so inexplicable. Like, these aren't the heroes in the story. These aren't the people I'm really interested in. I mean, even though that one cop is presented as sort of the good cop who's trying to clean it all up, it doesn't matter. The real interest is with the people who are actually rioting, who are actually being crapped on. And it was just such a strange turn to me.
Yeah, I mean, it was like if, I mean, though we do too much of comparing different civil rights movements, if Selma had cared a whole lot about, you know, one of the guys with dogs.
It really was like that, where it was like we're supposed to be really worried about this ferocious, corrupt cop world being taken down in this fire.
What? Okay. If you, as a forensic movie watcher.
Yeah.
What went wrong? Where?
Yeah, it's a great question because I was thinking about it in that level. Like, what would I have done with this script if somebody had given it to me and said, clean this thing up, make it work? And I think if, I mean, first of all, it just, that whole character, the Jeremy Irvine character, is just cliched. It's totally hackneyed.
There's nothing specific about him. He's only made of cliches.
No, it's like everything you've seen before. The uptight coach father who's too hard on him.
There was a brief moment when in that first scene where he's like making eyes with the coach, because you know that he's a coach because he's always wearing a hat that says coach.
He answers the phone, Coach Winners.
But like, there was a brief moment when I was like, oh, our lead character is getting molested by his coach. Like, that to me was like an interesting and more rich way of starting out talking about what functional adolescent homosexuality in the Midwest in 1969 was. But I should have expected no such subtlety from the man who loves blowing up the White House. Sorry I interrupted.
No, it's okay. And then I was going to say the other characters in that world were also cliched. The mother who's like the doormat who can't stand up to her husband. And then when he leaves, it's like, okay, that's the moment where I would have basically passed the baton in the story. Like, if you have to have that character, which I don't think at all you need to have that character, but let's just say for a moment, if you had to stick with that character, then you pass the baton. He gets to Stonewall, then you spread the story out to those people.
Yeah.
I mean, Ray, it should have been Ray's story.
Right.
I mean, that he's the best, most fleshed out character in the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you don't really, you know, and at the end, when he goes back to his family, no one cares by that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just completely, the story by then is, it has a different engine. The engine is about the Stonewall people, not about his family back home.
I feel like that movie just so was obsessed with a real normal man. Like, that the boy who he had been blowing back in, you know, buttfuck Indiana, like, that was the real normal guy who he was, the only thing who he could imagine loving. And that guy's so straight and normal that by the end of the movie, also we're spoiling all of this, but none of you are going to see this movie. like, he had ended up with a girl. Like, this movie was just so scared of gayness. Like, it tried to be about gay but was so scared of any of the specifics of gayness, any effeminacy, anything outside of just the most bland normalcy, along with some occasional sex with men. And, like, he spent of sexual encounters in that movie, in most of them, he was terrified and disturbed. Like, the sheer number of times that somebody blows him and
it's played for horror.
And it's
straight
played
up
for horror.
Horror.
Like, him having to have sex with somebody who isn't cute is really more devastating than the police coming and arresting people for attempting to go to a gay
bar. This literally sounds like Studio 54.
It's... Well, 54 is a much... 54, the movie. Is a much better gay movie than this. Let's take this transition. My reaction to this movie was that the 1999 gay romantic comedy Trick that takes place in, like, around Sheridan Square is a better movie about Stonewall.
With Tori Spelling.
With Tori Spelling.
Yes.
Because it does manage to sort of, like... There was a brief period of time in the late 90s that we attempted to make gay romantic comedies. And they weren't all entirely successful. They all had some difficulties. But this at least was sort of trying to explore the way that everybody has an uncertain relationship to sex and sexuality mm-hmm. and their own gay identity as they are sort of like getting into gayness. And the emotional story at the heart of it is sort of like Latino New York guy who's very, very good at the sex part but not really good at the gay part. Mm-hmm. And then little Midwestern boy who writes musicals but isn't good at the sex part. The two of them trying to find somewhere to fuck overnight
yes.
and not being able to find somewhere.
Great movie.
Yeah, the fact that Jeremy Irvine's character would not deign to ever have sex with Ray or anybody of color in the entire movie also just was like
at the end,
bothersome.
At the end, he says to the gorgeous but somewhat effeminate Puerto Rican boy who has been desperately in love with him, and we've ignored the Stonewall riots so that we could focus on this guy's romantic journey that never lands anywhere. What he says is, oh, I can't, Ray. We're just too different. Fuck you, dude.
Oh, my God.
Oliver.
I'm always curious about how films that are for, by, or about some kind of marginalized community, there is this sense of obligation that if you are a member of that community that you have to support this film despite mm-hmm. its flaws because this might be the only shot we have at making a Stonewall film. What was the lead up to Stonewall like? And was there that kind of pressure being explicitly or implicitly floated out there in terms of, I don't care what you think of the trailer, you have to go to this film because it's, you know, it's for us.
Well, it's very interesting. There was a movie from 1995 that mm-hmm. was also about a white fagsaya showing up before the Stonewall riots, his semi-romance with an effeminate Latino drag queen. That movie just kind of went under the radar because it was 90s indie time. With Stonewall, we have all of this machinery in place. Like, our media was just so aware of it because after the late 90s, we stopped getting movies of any reasonable budget that were for us, and now we only get gay dramas where we are portrayed by straight actors and all of that stuff. And it's not just a gay director. It's Roland Emmerich, who is kind of a heart of the gay community in Los Angeles. Like, he is having these twink-centric pool parties that a lot of people love to talk shit about. Because they are for the pretty boys, but are also providing more of a sense of heart and community than a lot of other people are doing here. So there was a lot of just sort of like social pressure to not be excessively judgmental of this film. Because this is the guy who stuck his neck out to be able to get this movie made. A lot of other people aren't doing it.
Yeah, I will say too that to be fair about the movie, there were scenes where his character, Irvine's character, is called out for having advantages that the rest of them don't. Yeah. I mean, it's not blind to the fact that he is in this different sphere and more privileged, and there are some moments where they take him down for it. So, I mean, I don't want to 100% say across the board that the movie had no good intentions, that it was, you know, not, that it was like made out of some malicious kind of intent to smear or kind of to completely whitewash the story and be insensitive to it. I think it just really, I've been thinking about this in terms of John Robin Bates,
yeah.
the playwright, who, or in this case, the screenwriter who wrote this screenplay. And I think his mentality was too much in the theater world when he was writing this. Like, I can see how this would have played much better in a theater context.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and especially, I also heard too, The friend that I went to see this movie with, 10 minutes into the movie, she leans over and she says, oh, my God, I've read this. I did coverage on this.
Oh, really?
6-7 years ago. So this has been rattling around in Hollywood for a while, which is also interesting because I do think 6-7 years ago we had a different idea about the way we told some of these stories than we do right now. I think the gay rights movement has gone on light speed in terms of what we have seen change and what we've seen come around in terms of gay marriage. So I think we're just in a different world now, and I don't think that screenplay caught up yet.
And the movie does attempt to wrestle with the notion of sort of like establishment politics versus like revolutionary politics, and sort of like it attempts to move past respectability politics while being so rooted in respectability politics that that's all you can really see from that movie. And that it feels can't like the last third of that movie, I did honestly wonder, is this a movie where I can get super drunk and yell at it? Because there is almost a camp, like the last third of the movie is campy. Like identifying with the police officers, the moment when, you know, our beloved hero grabs the brick and throws it and yells gay power.
Oh my God. I mean, we were howling at that moment, yeah. Which is not how that moment should have gone down.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, in the script, apparently, my friend April is telling me that John Robin Bates wrote into the script the kind of theatrical, not quite real feeling of Christopher Street.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think in a way, Roland Emmerich, like, obeyed the script.
Right.
Like, he just listened to what it was saying and thought, okay, I'm going to try to do this. And it was just the wrong impulse.
To come back to my question, though, the sense I got is that this film did not carry the burden of all eggs in one basket. Is that about right? That maybe we're at the point at where, and this kind of gets into the larger topic of just LGBT cinema and television in general, is that it's advanced far enough where one single show is not going to be seen as bringing down an entire movement if it fails.
Well, there are two things. One is I feel like gay guys particularly are much better at saying no, not that than we are at making culture of our own. And I try to be enthusiastic. Like, we all heard me talk shit about Looking. I made you guys watch Looking, and I made us do an episode about it. And there is a problem right now where we are good at writing the sassy, like, reviews of the movie, but don't have any answer for how you make a movie that isn't either this or, like, we have our weird low-budget rom-coms that have dicks in them that are terrible, but we all watch and know exist because those are our culture. Mm. But, yeah, there was a sense of we deserve – I mean, it was a very Stonewall sense of we deserve better than this.
Okay.
Of, like
versus Too Big to Fail, which is what I was saying.
In terms
of the idea that this film, like, we have to have it succeed because if it doesn't, then we're never going to get another one of these made and blah, blah, blah.
Right. I mean, this was I think our reaction to this would have been very, very different 10 or 15 years ago.
Okay.
Winner, what is a piece of culture or that you think, like, does get gayness, that does understand it?
Since I'm straight, I guess the one thing that I can think of the most would probably be Gia.
Uh-huh.
Gia was, like, to me, just based on having read about her and sort of done a lot of research, and then Angelina just really embodying what I think Gia would have been like. I liked how Gia possessed her. That wasn't her problem, being fluid sexually. It wasn't her problem being on drugs either. Her problem was just love. And in no matter whom she found it from, that she couldn't obtain it from, she didn't have a problem if it was a woman. She didn't have a problem if it was a man. So being sexually fluid, that was to me like one of the best representations of it. But I grew up with a lesbian aunt. So she was pretty confident about her lesbianism, and she didn't really have like issues when it was sort of brought up. She was, you know, being a lesbian in San Francisco was something that she was completely comfortable and confident in. So I think that was sort of her having just one of the guys on tape, on videotape, was like one of my favorite things.
Mm-hmm.
I just love that movie. And that movie to me too plays with sexuality because it conjures all these emotions with other people because they don't know why they're attracted to this person. They can't put their finger on exactly why they're attracted to the person that Joyce portrays. So that was like one of my favorites too.
Yeah. I mean, about Gia, we do lack nuanced representations of bisexuals. So frequently, like, bisexuality can be something that is just a joke or ignored. And I mean, about just one of the guys, like, we have been dealing with the notion of same-sex attraction and stuff as a source of play since, like, Shakespeare, but it is trying to sort of, like, put a finger on gay culture and, like, legit representations of gay culture that has been a little bit more elusive. Margaret, do you have any picks of something that you think works?
Oh, so many. I mean, I have a whole list written down of gay movies that I love.
Yeah.
You know, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I love that movie. I think John Cameron Mitchell is an amazing performer in it. Short Bus, which was his other movie that didn't get a lot of attention in the same way, but it still has this kind of crazy, eclectic, polyamorous, hedonistic vibe that I think is really good. Another one that I think is pretty undersung, but made a splash on, like, I think more the film festival circuit, is this movie Pariah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
No, what was it?
It's this coming out story about a, like, 17-year-old black lesbian in Brooklyn, and Spike Lee produced it, and it just has the most, like, it has this dark moodiness to it that's really beautifully done. It also makes really good use of that very dirty Kia song, My Neck, My Back.
Yeah.
I don't have to sing the other lyrics.
I don't know. I think we should do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, Orlando, too, is a movie that I love. I mean, that was, like, the Tilda Swinton, like,
right,
moment of, like, oh, my God, who is this amazing actress and how she could play gender fluidity. And so, in a way, I feel like all of her roles, to a certain extent, are about gender fluidity, but... and sexual fluidity, but Brokeback Mountain, too. I have to give it a shout.
The thing is, like, we get a lot of, again, dramas where straight people play us for potential Oscars is never really the problem. It is sort of the things that try to capture, like, what it means for your identity. Like, you know, it sounds like what you're describing from Pariah is a movie that's trying to sort of, like, get a person, like, figuring who she is and how she figures into the world.
Yeah, and, like, from a community that's not supportive and from a family that's not that supportive.
Right. Oliver.
Well, this leads back to both a question I had in general, and this, I think, also harkens back to something that you had brought up last week when we were talking about Transparent, about how for all the good intentions and the well-executed show that Transparent is, it's a show about trans people that doesn't actually cast anyone who's actually trans. It's basically non-trans people playing trans.
In main roles. Like, they've now, like, thickened out the cast with a lot of...
And they do have a lot of, like, consultants who are trans.
Yeah, right. Which I don't doubt. But I think the question here, which I'm always curious about, because when we think about how race plays a role in how things get casted, you know, there's now a hashtag of Emma Stone anytime an Asian character is played by a white person or that the Asianness has been erased. This is kind of an issue because the feeling is we, you know, people within the Asian American community, we're underrepresented in Hollywood anyways. So why is it that you're not creating more roles for us? And, you know, you think we're about at least, what, 30 years into kind of the mainstreaming of gay characters into television and cinema. But oftentimes, I mean, overwhelmingly, those characters are played by people who are actually straight. And you could maybe make the argument that in the beginning, if you're simply trying to mainstream LGBT culture, you'll take what you can get simply as a way of normalizing things. But again, we're several generations into that now. Is there a feeling of resentment that all of these gay characters still get played by straight people? And when are there going to be more roles for people who are actually LGBT to play those roles?
Well, I mean, you saw the Matt Damon quote about how people should not come out because it can hurt their career. That sort of is the problem. Thus far, I feel like the sentiment has been, let's take what we can get, and also a notion that we don't have a right to push back at straight performances of gayness. When, look, there are good ones. There are completely really, really good ones.
Right.
But then there are also a lot that feel terrible or mediocre or forced. And the worst stories are always when you hear about somebody who was, like, unwilling to kiss somebody on the lips. Like, you know, Will Smith was unwilling to kiss Anthony Michael Hall on the lips in Six Degrees of Separation, which was 20 years ago. But it's still like, fuck you, dude.
And, like, if you're an actor and you took this role, take the role.
Well, what everybody always says is you get the best person for the job. And you're not the best person if you're not going to be able to commit to that level. And it's a dangerous conversation because I think a lot of gay actors are like, well, I want to still be able to play straight roles. But for a lot of people, there just isn't the option because you are visibly, palpably gay. And I was more annoyed by the period of time when we had a bunch of – to me, it is most bothersome when the joke is, can you believe that this person who we know is not gay is playing gay? Andy Samberg as gay brother, Woody Harrelson as gay brother in rom-com. It's just like it feels minstrelly.
Right.
Though not – of course not to that extent, but it is a different sort of like
– But it's a very particular performance, a very kind of conventional idea of what gayness is like.
Right. And the thing is I always feel like when you have an actual gay character there, there is the ability to sort of like – indulge in the specificity of gayness without feeling like it's a caricature. And when it's a straight guy, there is this fear of they just don't have the capacity to understand the difference between a real honest portrayal and something that is just a collection of stereotypes.
I also feel like there's sort of an unintentional or subtle homophobia to the ways in which we praise straight people for playing either gay or lesbian, that somehow it's an amazing performance that you are able to embody like something that you're not, but in a way that it only really works when you think that somehow there's something incredibly transgressive about that.
Right.
You know?
That it's dangerous or gigantic, but you know, things are getting better. We'll like the one thing we're able to take away from this is nobody's that concerned about Stonewall, and we all trust that something better will come along. All right, you guys are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Allegra Ringo, a dog owner.
And I am Renee Culvert, a dog wanter.
And together, we're the hosts of Can I Pet Your Dog, a podcast for unapologetic dog lovers.
So let's talk about this. What are you getting yourself into? What is this podcast about?
Well, we have dog news, dog experts, and interviews with special guests about their dogs.
We also talk about dogs that we met this week.
Join us every Tuesday on MaximumFun.org for new episodes of Can I Pet Your Dog?
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Brand. And with me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Winter Mitchell, what's your current jam?
This version of I Can't Help It by Stevie Wonder wrote I Can't Help It, and he gave it to Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson actually begged him for it to put it on. I believe it was Off the Wall. So this is the actual version that he created that when Michael Jackson heard it, he was like, this has to be my song. Mm-hmm. So they just released it. I don't know who released it or why I've never heard this before, but I just found it on the SoundCloud, and it was like mesmerizing everybody on Saturday. And so it really, like, I listened to it like 5 times in a row.
Ready? 1, 2, start with A.
I love this already.
And I have to say, it's like... this version's a little bit better than Michael Jackson.
Sacrilege.
Yeah. It's just way more.
Looking in my mirror. Took me by surprise.
Yeah, Michael Jackson just can never be this effortless and cool.
He could. But it wasn't. It was for
and
a
early,
different time.
Early MJ.
Early MJ, maybe not. But like. He grew into this, and he could have, if he wasn't saddled by drug addiction in court cases, he probably would have been able to, like, really get to this point. But this is, at this point, Stevie was just...
Right. Like, he could do no wrong.
He could, yeah.
That said, Michael Jackson's version of the song is incredible.
It's incredible, yeah. But this studio version just... his voice just always sounds amazing.
Have you heard Stevie's original version of Until You Come Back to Me that Aretha Franklin ended up... music?
No.
Pretty cool, too.
He's just great.
I mean, yeah, he was writing for everyone back in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oliver, what's your jam this week?
Last week, I was talking about middle-aged hip-hop and what it is to be, you know, in your 40s, both as an artist and as a listener. But the more I thought about it, I mean, my three favorite albums of the year so far have been recorded by, you know, rappers all in their 20s. So it's Kendrick Lamar, it's Vince Staples, and I've been listening a lot to Mac Miller's new album, which is called Good AM or G-O, colon OD AM. So I'm just going to call it good.
They called it good AM on the radio station.
There you go. Good AM. Yeah. And specifically, it's a song that he does with LA's Ab Soul called Two Matches, which is a sequel to a song that they did on a mixtape called Matches.
When I was just a kid, dreamt that one day we'd all get rich. No more problems and no more tricks. I set my sights high, cause in my lifetime, man, I seen some shit. Yeah, I swear to God.
This is Soundwave from TDE on the beat, and who normally records with Ab Soul. And as much as I would like to feel like there is a space for, again, middle-aged hip-hop, dad rap, if you will, to me, hip-hop has always been youth-oriented, and it's where the music always feels at its most vital. And even if I'm not the key demographic that someone like a Mac Miller is rapping for, I would like to think I can still appreciate the kind of, again, energy and vitality that artists of his age are making for other listeners of the same age. And so, like I said, I've been gravitating towards all these 20-something rappers, even though I'm clearly not in my 20s anymore. But to me, that's still where the spark of hip-hop is best heard, and I've been just playing this one song, and the album in general I think is great, but this one song is just constant rotation for me.
This week, my jam is an homage to our main topic. It is a 1970s soft country song reinterpreted by a studio disco singer, which was then mixed into a dance song, which was then played in a 1999 gay romantic comedy while a go-go boy is on stage. And I believe it does a great job of capturing the many, many layers of gay culture. Here we go. But look how far. Oh, I've gained. Yeah. So it's a I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, the Jessica Williams dance mix. It's really trashy and terrible, but wonderful, and is exactly the kind of empowerment song I want to sing along to. Margot Wappler, what's your jam this week?
My jam is the Bleachers, who basically took their own album, Strange Desire, and had women come in and take over each of the songs. So they put together their own cover album with all female vocalists. There's like Sia on there, Tinashe, Sarah Bareilles. The song that I'm going to play is from Charlie XCX, and it's called Roller Coaster. And I liked it because it has this touch of summer. This was a summer song last summer from the Bleachers, who's Jack Antonoff, who's part of Fun, and this is sort of a side project. But at any rate, this is the new version of Roller Coaster with Charlie XCX, and it's very 80s and very just like your last parting whisper of summer. But like a teenage runaway, oh God, I never thought we'd take it that far. Some killer queen you are. Now I'm running and I can't stop. Anywhere I go, I think about it every day and that I can't let go. Sounds like Katy Perry. Well, I don't feel like Katy Perry would be this chill on the vocals, you know?
True.
She'd have to, like, blow it out and then dance on a cherry or something.
And it feels like 20 BPMs faster than maybe typical Katy Perry song. But the vibe is, it's a fun vibe, though.
Yeah. So bye-bye, Summer. Bye-bye. I've loved you so.
It's been great.
Goodbye, Summer. We loved you. Next week is Switcheroo Week here at Maximum Fun, which means that different hosts will be taking over every show, which means that I, God Branham, will be taking over Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I will be talking to Constance Wu from Fresh Off the Boat and Ron Nicewanner, who wrote Philadelphia Soldier's Girl in the upcoming film Freeheld. It will be crazy.
And the rest of us will be taking over Bunker Buddies with Travis McElroy.
Are you guys ready for the apocalypse?
We will be.
I think so. I still have some packing to do, some cooking and ironing.
Instant ramen to store away.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winnie Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Johnny Soups, Unknown 1985, Font Map, and Random K for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. We love to hear from you guys, whether it's a 5-star review or not. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. This week, tell us, what song will you absolutely always sing along to at the top of your voice? We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the very vocal Colin Anderson.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.